Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Brian Epstein first proposed being the Beatles manager on December the 3rd, 1961. Less than 5 years later, on August the 29th, 1966, the Beatles strode off stage of their last gig at San Francisco's Candlestick Park. At that point in time, all that Brian Epstein had achieved would have been unfathomable at the start of the decade. What was his business model supposed to be next, now that his main charges, the Beatles, had decided to cease playing by the standard show business rules? What was possible was unknown at that point in 1966, as was the fact that Brian would die 1 year later. He, like many things in the Beatle universe, crammed a lot into a short period of time, didn't he, Stephen?
Yes, I think, as you say, in all the aspects of their career, you're looking at people that really were forging a new path. They were sort of doing things that had never been done before. They were doing things that were outside their experience. And Brian, perhaps as much as, you know, Paul and John's songwriting or George Martin's production, this was uncharted territory.
Mm. And I think, you know, to let a little light in on magic, one of the biggest things we've been asked for over the years of doing this podcast is a Brian episode. And we touched upon him in our fifth Beatles episode a little bit because he does warrant this fifth Beatle name. He's been credited by the Beatles themselves as being a fifth Beatle from time to time, him and George Martin. And I think the more we looked at it, the more we realised it's a huge topic.
It's absolutely vast. He's a very complicated character, and it's a very complicated story, and it's got lots of little sort of side diversions. And so what we decided to do was just look at the last 12 months of his life.
Mm.
Start at the end.
Exactly. And what I was very surprised about, one of the many surprises about the Get Back Peter Jackson movie, was the shadow of Brian and how that is played throughout Get Back. And, you know, there's definitely Brian Beatles, and then a post Brian Beatles, you know, once he dies, that things do change, the dynamic does change, and we'll talk about that across these episodes. But he's, they're very definite about it. The many kind of things that are shifted in Peter Jackson's Get Back, it's that saying that, you know, when Brian dies, something very important changes. And I think looking at that last year, you know, you kind of tease out the things that could have happened, or, you know, you can start to look at, well, could there have been a, you know, what would his role have been if he was still around in 69?
I think that's right. Get Back in particular, I was not expecting Brian to loom quite as largely as he does. The fact that they, you know, they don't call him Brian, they call him Mr. Epstein.
Mm.
They're still, we know John famously sort of said he realized that when Brian died, that was it. You know, they'd had it. But to see that 2 years after he died, or 18 months after he died, they were still referring back. And, you know, when Mr. Epstein went away, or they talked, you know, we're still looking for Daddy. And the terms and the language that they use in referring to him, I think, is very telling. He supervised their career. He, even if he wasn't responsible, in their minds, you know, it was all happening at the same time. It was all happening under his supervision. So he becomes responsible, that he facilitates their rise to, you know, being the biggest thing in the world.
Well, he was a great gatekeeper for many things and a great filter. And I think overall, he deserves credit. And was he a good manager? Is that a fair question? Or he was the best manager for the Beatles, I think, is the statement.
I think that that's something that you phrase you used whenever we had Mark Lewis and all, and you said, you know, they got the manager that they needed, the manager they deserved. And I think that's as much as you can say. You can't objectively really assess his skills as a manager. You can say, you know, he was deficient here, or he was very good there, or he, you know, his business acumen left something to be desired, but he was the perfect manager for them at the time.
It's an interesting thing, because what you kind of get with the start of rock and roll is the managers start to become a little bit famous. You know, Larry Parnes becomes famous. You know, there's documentaries about Larry Parnes and the pre-Beatle British rock and roll world, and how, you know, he's getting people ready for success. And in the 60s, you meet all these management types. So Andrew Lloyd Oldham and the Rolling Stones, Stamp and Lambert and The Who, these people become famous themselves. Even the Kinks had a very specific type of management group, Collins and Wace were their names. And each of those is a different style. Like Oldham for the Stones was very much trying to manipulate the media. Stamp and Lambert were also kind of media manipulators, but they were also arch. Lambert was very much in tune with Pete Townsend's kind of artistic sensibilities. Whereas, you know, the Kinks managers are total novices, didn't know what they were doing, signing bad contracts. So you kind of see this panoply. And Brian, not every decision he made was great, but he very much plugged into the art side of the Beatles.
I think that's right. And one of the things you can say is that he clearly modelled himself on the type of manager from the generation before or a few generations back. He was an impresario.
Yes.
And this, I think, becomes even more pronounced in the last 12 months of his life. You know, he was hanging out with Lionel Bart. One of his very closest friends was Al McCogan, who was a singer from the 50s and was regarded as deeply unhip by the time 1963 arrived. But he was moving in those sort of traditional, slightly effete English London theatre circles. It was showbiz in a kind of classic definition, as opposed to, you know, by the time we get into the 70s, you've got people like Peter Grant, who are, you know, punching bootleggers and smashing yes. up unofficial T-shirt concessions. So he's very much in an old style. He comes out of the 50s in a way that the Beatles don't. You know, the Beatles are tapping in the 50s to the sort of the changes that are happening. And Brian is not of their world.
But what he did bring to the Beatles was he did absolutely love them. And we'll talk about this in a bit. He did manage many other people as well. But the Beatles were, you know, that the Beatles didn't realise that they needed somebody who would kind of love them and go to bat for them and be their sort of showbiz parent, which is exactly what he was. You know, the Stones didn't need that type of management, but the Beatles did. And Brian's kind of MO was to try and, you know, he felt he loved them, so everyone else should love them as well. That seemed to be his main aim for the band.
Yes, I think so. You know, he was almost a father figure. And, you know, this taps into all sorts of things, particularly with Lennon and, you know, that need in his life for someone to kind of take control. But then also that you're constantly let down by that person. So whether it's your father or it's your manager or it's your spiritual advisor or your psychiatrist or psychologist, or Lennon is constantly sort of seeking that figure in his life. And that's Brian filled that role. And it's interesting to and we maybe come on to it in, if not in this episode, but in other episodes about, you know, Brian had a very different relationship with each of the four members of the band, as well as the band collectively. But you're right. I think the overriding thing is, from the moment he saw them, he was telling people, I love these people. I adore these people. They're going to be the biggest thing in the world.
Yeah.
That's an easy thing for anybody to say. If I first meet you and I think, Jason, you're going to be the biggest podcaster in the world. But yeah, it's
still waiting.
Then it happens. We're still waiting for that to happen, obviously. But you know what I mean? There is a sense of his enthusiasm and his love for the band that he communicates to everybody that he deals with.
Well, it's easy in retrospect, you know, because the world loves the Beatles, et cetera, et cetera. But for him to actually, you know, walk into a room, and obviously there were fans at that time in Liverpool, but for him to say, yep, this is it. You know, it wasn't like he was auditioning any other bands or he had made this his life's work. But for him to have that massive penny drop and to actually follow through on it, for somebody who could be somewhat unreliable in certain matters in his life, it was very impressive that he managed to be true and to deliver on that one.
Yes, there was a lot for Brian to kind of hold together
Yeah.
And the whole point about the first sort of 3 years, I suppose, post Love Me Do of the Beatles' career, there is this phenomenal forward momentum. And so you don't have time to stop and think. Mm. None of them do. Brian, least of all, you're constantly reacting to what's happening, to something that is spiraling out of control. And eventually it starts to get beyond all of them. It gets bigger than all of them, and it's something that cannot be controlled. And that's particularly exacerbated, I think, once they stop touring.
Yes.
Because that is a huge driver for that forward momentum.
So we want to focus on the last year of Brian's life, but I guess we need to do, a la Peter Jackson's Get Back, a little quick summary of Brian's life up until 1966.
Yes. So in the beginning, the earth cooled and dinosaurs roamed the land.
And skip forward a bit.
Brian Epstein was born in 1934.
Yes. So he was 31 at the time of Candlestick Park. And he's born into a very comfortable, affluent Liverpool Jewish family who've based themselves famously in town by having North End Music Stores and Epstein & Stone stores across the city. So they are well known.
They're well known. They're established. I think Paul's father bought the piano there at the music store. So that they are very respectable in that sense. The other thing is they are Jewish. So to that extent, they're kind of slightly apart as well.
Yeah.
So, and it's that sort of slight outsider status, I think, that Brian wears not particularly lightly sometimes. But yeah, they're very respectable, and they're probably as far away as you can get within Liverpool from, Ringo and George and living in their upbringing.
Yeah, and from also the Beatles' original manager, Alan Williams. You know, he's a different type of businessman.
Yes. Yes, and he has no background. Brian has no background in management. His background is in retail. Mm-hmm. You know, he's been to RADA. He wanted to be an actor. He wanted to be a dress designer. He has no aspirations to be managing a rock band.
Yes.
It's that intersection of working in the retail trade, selling a record, that brings him into their orbit. And as I say, there's some kind of instantaneous love at first sight thing that's going on there with him. Against, it's confounding his family's expectations. It's confounding the social expectations of the time. And even, I suppose, it's completely the antithesis of what Brian has seen for her as his own career path.
But yes and no. I mean, you can kind of see, I guess there wasn't so many paths for people to take perhaps back in that day. But he certainly, you could argue, or an argument could be made to say, well, look, he grew up in a household that dealt in, you know, business and accounts. But he was obviously somebody who, you know, he was homosexual. So he had an affinity towards creative arts and he had an affinity towards acting. But from what we know, he had no particular skill at acting. But it does make sense to think that, well, he came from a business family. He was interested in showbiz. So he went into the business side of showbiz. It's not the greatest leap of all time. It just mightn't have been obvious to anyone at that point in time.
No, I mean, I think if you'd asked him, he would have seen himself as a theatre impresario or something in legitimate theatre. And his interests sort of lie in that direction, I think.
And as we will see in the last year of his life, those sort of threads come back to the surface. If that's not too much of a mixed metaphor, do threats come to a surface?
Yeah.
Who knows? So the origin story of Brian as manager is that Raymond Jones walks into the NEMS shop, asks for a copy of My Bonnie, a single which he had heard, and Brian goes off and sees the group and falls in love. However, Paul would sometimes say, you know, Brian must have known perfectly well who the Beatles were because we were on the front cover of Merseybeat and he was selling Merseybeat in his shop, and, you know, how would you not notice that?
Yes, and I mean, at one point he's writing a column, Stop the World, in Merseybeat. So there's a slow drift because of the record shop, into that into that world. And then, as you say, in December 61, he suddenly proposes this idea of managing them.
Yeah. And there is an incredible forward momentum. So if you think, you know, December 61, he proposes managing them. By December 62, you know, they've had a first single out and in the charts. By December 63, you know, they're onto their second album. They're just about to crack America. By December 64, they're the biggest group in the world. By December 65, they are still the biggest group in the world, if not even bigger. And we're into the realm of, you know, Rubber Soul and them starting to get into the world of reinvention. So 1966 is where we're going to start our Brian story. And famously, the Beatles played their last gig on Candlestick Park on the 29th of August, 1966. Do you know what day of the week that was, Stephen?
I do not, Jess.
It was a Monday.
Who goes to a gig on a Monday?
Who goes to a gig on a Monday? And the Beatles had had a very odd touring schedule in 1966, which would obviously be enough for a standalone episode itself. They did a two-part world tour, which had 20 dates in total, with some of those were double shows, where they go to Germany, Japan and Philippines in the end of June, start of July, which provokes the excellent trivia question.
When did the Beatles play their last gig in Hamburg? And everyone says 1962.
Yeah, but no. They played 26th of June 1966 in Hamburg, West Germany, but in the much larger Ernst Merck Halle. They have their catastrophic shows in the Philippines on the 4th of July, and then they've got another few weeks off. The album Revolver comes out on August the 5th. So that's their, you know, only album release of 1966. So the pace of Beatles releases is changing. And then essentially they go off on what you could call the North American Revolver Tour, which runs from the 12th of August to the 29th of August. It's 14 dates in total. 13 of those dates are in the US, where they play 16 shows. One of those dates is in Canada, where they do two shows in Toronto. And it's the tour where, as I said, it's an episode in itself. John has said they're bigger than Jesus, and that's overshadowing the tour. The experience in Manila a month earlier is overshadowing the tour. Anybody who's looked at any of the press conferences from that time, you're dealing with a very surly, world-weary band.
Yes, and I mean, particularly, there's very good colour footage of the shows in Japan at the Budokan, and they just look exhausted.
Yeah.
And the point is made that well, 2 points, I suppose. One, it's the Revolver tour. They're promoting Revolver, and they're not playing a single song from the album. And in Japan, they can hear themselves play for the first time in 3 years, because they're quite polite. The audiences, they're quite reserved. They scream between the songs, but they don't scream during the songs. And the Beatles, I think, become increasingly conscious of the fact that they're just, that their stagecraft is slipping away, and they don't sound great, and they just sound tired. And, you know, if we'd been in the audience in 1966 and you could hear them play, objectively, you'd be thinking, this isn't very good.
Well, they talk about it in Anthology. There's that great footage where they're singing Paperback Writer in Budokan, and they're waving to the crowd to get them to scream, to cover all the mistakes they made. And it's another example of one of these kind of Beatle flash in the pan moments that looms large in their lunchtime, because it's only three dates that they spend in 3 days that they spend in Tokyo, but it's something that, you know, seems to have really resonated with them. And then they hit Manila on the way back, and that's a whole other world of pain. So when they get to the North American part of the tour, they kind of, you know, in 1965, they'd kind of broken the mold in terms of playing, you know, Shea Stadium and playing stadiums for the first time. This tour, another Anthology moment, you know, Shea Stadium is on the bill a second time, and they don't even remember playing it. And you could argue that, you know, their star is on the wane. It's not the big sellout shows that they're used to.
No, I mean, by this stage, the big band in America was Herman's Hermits. They'd taken over as the fan favorite. I mean, there's that little clip of a girl being interviewed outside one of the shows. She said, you know, yeah, they're good, but, you know, they're not as good as Herman's Hermits. And I think there is this sense that they're sort of outgrowing their audience in to a degree. That, you know, the girls that are being interviewed for that clip, that I think shows up in Anthology, they're all quite young.
Yeah.
So of course they're going to like Herman's Hermits. You know, a year from now they're going to like the Monkees.
Yeah.
While the Beatles are kind of moving on to so they're not, they're taking their audience with them, but they're not getting the new 12 and 13 year olds are kind of thinking, well, that's, you know, my big sister's group or my big brother's group, or so they're still selling. You know, they're still selling. There's still no other band at the time that could fill a stadium.
Yeah.
Except on this tour, they're not quite filling the stadiums. So ticket sales are down. They're still selling tens of thousands of tickets, and they're still playing in stadiums, but there are some empty seats. And with the whole kind of bigger than Jesus controversy and all the rest of it, it all feeds into that. So then, you know, you get somebody is on a pedestal, you're always looking to try and knock them down. So then there are the press stories about, are the Beatles on the way in? So touring experience has become difficult.
There's a certain wisdom to them stopping touring here because, as you say, ticket sales are down. And the narrative about the Beatles stopping touring is always, well, we've done it and we wanted to experiment, we wanted to expand, and etc., etc. You very rarely hear the argument of, well, they stopped touring because they weren't selling as many tickets as they used to. And if it was to be a, you know, if they were seeing it as, well, we've reached the peak and it's a diminishing sum game from this point out, you know, they don't really need the look of going out on a 67 tour and they're selling half as many tickets again. You know, there's a pragmatic decision here that they don't want to be seen to be failing potentially.
Yeah. Although I think the driver is they're just exhausted. They're just fed up.
Oh,
It's a diminishing return, not only financially, but it's a diminishing return, I would have thought, emotionally or psychologically. They're not. You know, they've done all of this. They've had that particular high in 1965. It's not the same high in 1966, and it's becoming a drag.
Yeah.
In 1966, it's not something that they enjoy, and that I think is the and. They are sort of approaching it in different ways. So, you know, it's George is the one that's most often quoted as saying, that's it, I'm not a Beatle anymore after Candlestick Park. But, you know, in Anthology, Ringo pinpoints John as the one that doesn't want to tour.
Yeah.
Paul is always the one that says, you know, he was least in favor of giving up, but then became persuaded. And Ringo is just Ringo, you know, well.
I'll do what they say.
I'll do whatever we have to do. So, again, the sort of the band, collective band dynamic is changing at this point as well. And we've seen a little bit of that in the Revolver sessions as well, where there are some tensions. So I think the main driver is the fact that they're just, well, we're not doing this. We're not going to be bundled into vans. We're not going to be threatened, you know, on stage in Memphis, you know, there's a firecracker goes off and they think someone's taking a shot at John, and you know, we're just not prepared to put up with this. It's just not worth it. And what we also have to keep in mind throughout this episode is Brian's central role in touring.
Yeah.
You know, he is there every step of the way with them. He is Mr. Fix-It. He is there speaking to the police, speaking to the theatre managers, speaking to the local dignitaries whose wives all want to get photographed with the Beatles. He is there every step of the way on the tour, completely involved in that aspect of their life.
Yeah. If we look at some numbers about that Monday night in Candlestick Park, the capacity was 42,500, but only 25,000 tickets were sold. So at about 60%. So there was large sections of unsold seats. Tickets were $4.50 to $6.50 each, and the Beatles' fee was around $90,000. I went off and looked at historical exchange rates for 1966, because such is my wont. Exchange rates in the 60s didn't move day to day in the way that we kind of expect them to move. So there was kind of almost a fixed rate of $2.80 to the UK pound in 1966. So $90,000 would give you £32,000 in 1966, which adjusted for inflation is £634,000 for the Candlestick Park gig. Mr. Wilson devalued the pound the following year to $2.40 per pound, and then we developed
it. Well, you know, 634,000, I would quite frankly do 20 minutes at Candlestick Park for $600,000.
Well, that is the thing, like the overheads are like the Beatles took 65% of the gross, the city of San Francisco took 15% of the admissions, and the promoter did not make money, but they only performed 11 songs. And as you've sort of alluded to there, and as we kind of know, you know, they are not, this is the Revolver tour, and they are playing nothing off Revolver. They're playing, let's just go through the list, Rock and Roll Music. So they're opening with Rock and Roll Music. She's a Woman, If I Needed Someone, Day Tripper, Babies in Black, your favourite, I Feel Fine, Yesterday, I Want to Be Your Man, Nowhere Man, Paperback Writer, and then ending on Long Tall Sally, like Wings would end on. So yeah. it's a very neat type of an 11-song gig.
If Revolver comes out while they're on this tour, and if I'd been sitting at home listening to that and then trotted along to buy one of those unsold seats in Candlestick Park, I think I'd be a bit disappointed if I didn't hear something off Revolver. And I'm not suggesting they bring a string quartet on and do Eleanor Rigby, but there are songs there that could have been performed. But yet they're going back to Babies in Black, which is definitively the worst song they ever recorded. So very strange.
But it does bring up this question of, did they know it was their final concert or not? Because Paul gets Tony Barrow to tape it because he thinks it's the final concert.
Yes. So Tony Barrow, the press officer, he's there, and he says, Paul said, can you just tape this concert? Now, I always assumed that this was Tony Barrow lugging a huge reel-to-reel machine, but it was actually recorded on a cassette that had a 30-minute playing time on each side. And Tony Barrow records it, and because he doesn't switch the tape over, it just runs out at the end, so they don't get the last little section of Long Tall Sally. And I think that's kind of quite fitting.
It's a metaphor.
I think if they ever run this through the Giles Martin demixing machine, they shouldn't be flying in the second half of Long Tall Sally from a Memphis gig. They should just let it just go.
Well, I'm sure there'll be AI technology in the next few years to go, hey, the first half sounded like this. Can you just tell us what the second half would have sounded like? And we'll just have a...
We don't want that.
Don't we? Of course we do.
No, we don't.
Imagine a button where you could just get a Beatles album every day through AI. It'd be great.
It's very fitting that the last song of the last concert just cuts off midway through. I think that's a nice, you know... It's like, what's that song on Abbey Road that does that?
Her Majesty.
It's just the same. I want you.
Oh, I want you.
It's just like that. It's a foreshadowing. You see, everything is a foreshadowing of something. You're the foreshadowing guy.
It's all connected. So they're in San Francisco. They're doing this gig, but this is an episode about Brian Epstein. And
oh yeah, I'd forgotten that. Yeah.
So what is his life like in San Francisco? Because this is a very different window into the existence and the world of the group and Brian at that time.
Yes. Brian's back at the hotel in San Francisco, and he's with Nat Weiss, who was an American lawyer that had become a very close friend of his, who would go on to be involved in sort of the American side of the NEMS operation. But Brian was also reconnecting with John Diz. See what they did there, Gillespie.
Diz, like Dizzy Gillespie. Yeah.
Who, and I'm just going to check the notes here. He was an American aspiring actor / model.
Hmm. And he was a boyfriend or a former boyfriend of Brian's, and the Beatles. He's one of the Brian boyfriends that the Beatles knew about.
Yes. Yes. Paul has said, you know, they were aware that Brian was gay, and it wasn't an issue for them at all. But generally, I think he kept that side of his life separate and apart. But Diz Gillespie seems to have been different. So he was someone I think that Brian had met in New York. He came to London and Brian put him on a retainer of £50 a week. He was officially sort of signed to NEMS, and he was the only sort of actor that was signed to NEMS. Everyone else was, you know, Cilla Black and the Beatles and Jerry and the Pacemakers. So, it was a relationship because he was in London. The Beatles met him. By all accounts, the Beatles didn't particularly care for him. The relationship soured. Within 6 months, he's back in New York. The next thing that I'm aware of is in April 65, Brian is in New York to oversee Cilla Black's appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. And Gillespie effectively threatens Brian, supposedly holds a knife to his throat, steals some money. So the whole relationship had descended to that level. Nat Weiss had intervened, confronted Gillespie back in 65 and paid him off.
Yeah, gave him $3,000 to just go away and leave Brian alone.
Yeah. And then here we are back in San Francisco a year later. He resurfaces
and, you know, once bitten and all the rest. But while the Beatles are teeing up their Candlestick Park appearance, Brian is dealing with John Diz Gillespie re-entering his life, and essentially more madness ensues. He basically breaks into their hotel.
Yeah, more of the same. So Brian at first, and this is kind of characteristic of Brian as well, he seems quite pleased to see him. So despite all that has gone before, Brian is trusting this guy again. And what happens is he steals $20,000 in cash in Brian's briefcase and Nat Weiss's briefcase, but also contracts relating to the Beatles tour and Brian's supply of barbiturates, these illegal, not officially prescribed. He delivers a ransom note for another $10,000.
And Nat Weiss, who seems to be a great friend and confidant and a support to Brian, who gets things done, as you said, he ran the US Nemperer side of NEMS, which was kind of acting in based in New York and acting as kind of the US window for all their business interests in North America. Nat Weiss hires a private investigator and gets Diz Gillespie arrested. They recover 10K, but the drugs are not recovered.
But that's a good thing, because if the drugs had been recovered, then the police would have been aware that Brian Epstein, that man that manages the Beatles, was carting a briefcase full of illegal drugs around the state. So actually, the fact that the drugs are missing or presumably have been consumed, always eat the evidence, Jason. Always eat the evidence.
Or maybe the private investigator was told, if you find drugs, chuck the drugs, just get us the money.
Get the drugs down the toilet. But this is a major embarrassment to Brian and a kind of psychological blow to him, because he has kind of trusted this guy again. And this seems to be a pattern that repeats itself in this type of personal relationship, that Brian gets involved, trusts the person, really kind of opens up to them. And then when he is let down or betrayed or robbed or held at knife point, this is the point that he realizes, I'm not a good judge of character. This is not a good situation to be in. And, you know, we've all been there, but, you know.
Well, it is a microcosm of the flip side of Brian, because, you know, to the outside world, he is the impresario, as you say, standing with his hands behind his back, looking into the corners of the stadium, making sure the boys are all okay. And simultaneously, at the same side, there's this total amalgam of, the people who have come in to meet him through his lifestyle to take advantage of him, coupled with his drug use, because he has been using drugs basically throughout his whole time managing the Beatles, and then, you know, his whole sort of dealing in cash, business managing. I know there was a lot of cash around in showbiz at that time anyway, but it's all just there. So it's amazing how none of that was really, like, that would have been a scandalous news story back in 1966, you know, Beatles manager in extortion plot, you know. And yes, yet, I mean, you know, I'm sure some people must have known, but it certainly didn't get out there.
It is amazing to me that it didn't get out there, that this story didn't break. And I don't really know why that is. I don't really know why that is. But Brian Dawes seemed to have been very naive in so many aspects of his life, both the business, but also in his personal life. When he connected with people and made friends with Nat Weiss, people like that, it's a friendship that is very deep, and very, he's able to rely on that. And Nat Weiss comes to his rescue, I suppose, on a number of occasions. But he also then just opens himself up in a similar way to ne'er-do-wells.
Mm. And it's this notion of there's a certain type of side to Brian that, you know, likes living on the edge. His other big vice is gambling as well.
Yes, yes. I think that's right. I think it's the, you know, it's presumably the thrill of the potential for it all going horribly wrong, or the potential for getting caught, that there's something illicit and there's a danger and there's a thrill. But then when that comes to pass, there's no learning from that. There's no, I know I'm coming across as a very censorious lawyer, but there is no learning from this experience, that this is not a good thing. This is not a good thing to do. You know, the one thing, he comes across as being a very isolated character. Hmm. So he has this very, very close relationship with the Beatles. He has one or two extremely close friends, but there's a whole side of him that he can't share one side of his life with the Beatles, and he doesn't want to share the Beatles side of his life with anybody else. And there's a tension there, I think.
It might be very remedial or basic to say, but, you know, it was 1966. Homosexuality was illegal in the UK at that point in time, and that's obviously a huge burden for him, or it's a huge, certainly psychological burden for him, that it sort of feeds into this sense of Brian being two people, or getting very adept at taking parts of his life and putting them away where nobody can see them.
I think so. I think it's that compartmentalization. Yeah. And, you know, but earlier in his life, you know, he had been arrested, you know, and there had been court proceedings. With this kind of show business people that he's surrounded with, his sexuality isn't an issue, but it is for everybody else. His particular kind of thrill seeking, or that sort of dangerous aspect of that aspect of his life, leaves himself wide open to the exploitation by the likes of Diz Gillespie. On the other hand, he's appearing on TV, he's presenting a completely different persona. And I think you're right. It's if you live your life in that way, and you have these different compartments, you can never really open up to one single person, or you can't share across this. So you become increasingly isolated within those little compartments. We're getting very deep.
Getting
here.
Into amateur psychology hour here. But that's where we're at. It's August the 29th. The Beatles are dealing with the future of a life off the road and what that potentially means. Brian is dealing with an extortion plot from an ex boyfriend. And, you know, once you hit September 1966, everybody needs a break. And do you know who else needs a break, Stephen?
We need a break.
Yeah, we need a break. We'll be right back after this.
End of part one. Intermission. End of intermission. Part two.
Welcome back. So it's September 1966, and the Beatles have made their last proper paid public concert appearance in Candlestick Park in San Francisco. And 66 is an odd year for the Beatles overall, because they've been on this treadmill of two albums a year and four singles. And in 66, it's the year where they release the least. They put out Revolver and they put out Paperback Writer Rain. They just put out 16 songs in 66. Very lazy.
Very lazy. Slacking. Absolutely. Terrible work rate.
Yeah, absolutely lazy. So, you know, September 66 is earmarked as, you know, a time to take a break and to reflect and to think. And so George and Patty fly to Bombay on September the 14th. John Paul and Brian take a little weekend break in Paris on September the 16th. And then John 2 days later on September the 18th, applies to Almeria in Spain, where he's due to get involved with How I Won the War, the Dick Lester movie. And then Paul, after being in Paris, decides to drive around France in the skies. Classic Paul move.
Classic Paul move. Stick on that moustache. And is this the point at which he can't get into a club and then he has to whip off the moustache and go, but it's me, c'est moi.
I mean, I know we've mentioned it before, but that photo of Paul in disguise at the George Harrison gig, beautiful. Absolutely
it's fantastic. He's got form.
It's great. What this kind of tells us is that, you know, the Beatles are, you know, obviously they've always had their own separate lives, but they're reaching out, and, you know, George is particularly taking his India duties seriously at this point. That's his number one priority, is to get out over there. Where does Brian go, though, apart from his little visit to Paris?
Brian goes to the Priory.
Now, the Priory is, possibly quite well known to listeners on this side of the Atlantic. It's a very famous, when celebrities get a bit tired and emotional, they go to the Priory.
They go to the Priory.
To use a euphemism. And it's perhaps came to prominence in the 90s, you know, but it predates Noel Gallagher and all those other people. It's been around since 1872 as a private mental health institution. And it's, you know, throughout the 20th century, it evolved into a center that specialized in, addictions, you know, many addiction-based problems. And so people would go to the Priory as this private mental health institution to detox, to get, psychology, get counseling, whatever kind of associated.
To get well, Jason, to get well.
To get well, to battle their demons and to overcome their addictions. And so Brian, as many later year pop stars would do, went to the Priory at the end of September 1966. And this, it's a bit of a revolving door for Brian and the Priory, really, isn't it?
It is. You imagine he has a room permanently reserved for him during 66, 67. I was surprised that I knew that he'd sort of checked in somewhere, but I always assumed the Priory was, as you say, a sort of late 80s, early 90s invention. But it does, I think nowadays it does have a kind of degree of celebrity cachet about it. You know, if I become addicted to podcasting, I will check in there. I will then sell my story to Hello Magazine.
I don't think that's a risk. But the only famous person I can find from the 60s was Paul Robeson, was in the Priory before Brian.
Ah, right. Okay.
There you go.
Okay. But I suppose what I'm trying to say is that you know, these days, there's no shame in going to the Priory. In fact, it's the source of income because you can sell your story if you're a celebrity. But in the 60s, this would not have been looked on in the same way, you know?
It's another part of Brian's kind of need to compartmentalize, really, you know, that he's, you know, this is another thing he has to do that, you know, he really doesn't want people to find out about, you know.
Well, exactly. And I think the timeline is interesting here because it's like literally just shy of 1 month after they play their last gig that Brian has checked into the Priory to decompress.
But he's not there for long, because by the 15th of October he's back in North America with Georgie Fame.
Yes. And again, Georgie Fame is not someone with whom you necessarily associate Brian Epstein. But this is indicative of, and we've come on to this, just the sheer volume of people that he's dealing with. You know, the range of artists and he has many fingers in many pies.
Well, should we just have a quick look at that? Because if you take a snapshot of Brian's NEMS business at the end of 1966, he has this massive roster. We kind of see him, you know, as the Beatles guy, but he's overseeing a roster with about 40 different acts. At the top of the tree are the Beatles, followed by Cilla Black and Jerry Marsden, Jerry and the Pacemakers. But there's a whole bunch of other groups there. So I'm just looking at a list you have here. So you've got Billy J. Kramer, Big Three, the Foremost, who perhaps Mersey Beat is not quite the world-beating phenomenon by the end of 1966 that it was. Tommy Quickley, the Remo Four, the Moody Blues. So Denny Lane knocking around in early Moody Blues. Michael Haslam?
No idea.
A group called the Paramounts, who they?
Procol Harum, to
they
me.
They are Procol Harum to me. Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers, Paddy Klaus and Gibson. Klaus being Klaus.
And there's also a band called The Circle, who are a bit of an anomaly in the NEMS universe.
Yes, The Circle are the only American artists, the only American band signed to NEMS. And this arises out of, we talked briefly about the relationship with Nat Weiss and Nemperor, which was an American entity set up to deal, basically to parallel what NEMS were doing in the UK. Nat Weiss saw this band at that stage. They were called the Rondells. He offered them a record deal, said, "Hey guys, I know Brian Epstein." And I think there was some skepticism about this. And but anyway, eventually he signs them, and they have a number one hit single with Red Rubber Ball, and then a follow-up, Turn Down Day. To the extent that they are so successful that Nemperor is able to repay within a year the loan that they had taken to set this up. And the loan was actually provided by Jape Music, J-A-E-P Music. They are or were an English music publishing company that published George Harrison's Don't Bother Me. And J-A-E-P stands for Dick James and Brian Epstein. I'd never known that, but that is not either a Northern Songs or a Harry Songs. That's a Jape Music song. I'm sure George
loved that.
Thrilled with
absolutely
that kind
delighted
of, arrangement.
But Red Rubber Ball was a Paul Simon song.
Yes.
Curiously.
Yes, indeed,
so they had a big hit with a Paul Simon, an unknown Paul Simon.
They had a big hit with that. And then, of course, they were joined to the Beatles tour as a support act. So that helped. But I've read in one telling that it was John Lennon that said, you know, don't like the Rondells, The Circle. And that's C-R-Y-K-L-E in a hey, psychedelic kind of way.
It's a very late 66 type of name, really, isn't it? The Circle.
It is. And but they had songwriters in the band that wrote as well. And they went off to be jingle writers. And I think I this may be more for American listeners, but there's a kind of plop, plop, fizz, Alka-Seltzer jingle that they wrote. Apparently quite big in big in America, jingle circle.
Well, you're listening to the Jingle Cast. That's interesting. That's The Circle. So, but it's interesting with this huge roster on NEMS. How is Brian? I mean, Brian is obviously not day to day dealing with everybody in minute detail. He's overseeing this empire, and it's set up. Obviously, Brian is the main owner. So the directors of NEMS are Brian and his brother Clive. Brian owns 70% of the shareholding. Clive, his brother, owns 20% of the shareholding. And then the remaining 10% is split 2.5% each for John, Paul, George and Ringo. It's curious that they are getting a very small percentage of the huge amount of money coming in from Tommy Quickley, a little bit of it.
a little bit
come on,
the
Tommy,
top.
2.5% of the 15% you're giving to me is going into Ringo's pockets to be taxed at 90%.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. It's like that, what's that King song, The Money Go Round?
The Money Go Round, like. Yeah.
But it's a big deal. It employs 80 staff in 5 different London offices, and it has this Nemperor connection, this other business that it's associated with in New York. And at the top of the tree, you have this guy who is not the most reliable, we're beginning to find out.
Yes. And I mean, the thing is that when Brian is invested in a particular artist, and his key charges seem to be the Beatles, Cilla Black, and Gerry and the Pacemakers. And Gerry and the Pacemakers are going to split up quite shortly, and Gerry's going to go on to a solo career of sorts. But when Brian is invested, you know, Brian will personally arrange for flights, private jets to fly Cilla Black here, there and everywhere. He'll send one of his assistants, Alistair Taylor, up to sort of hold her hand at various things. So he's in one sense, he's deeply involved in the personal arrangements for some of these artists.
Yeah.
But you do then get other people saying, other on that roster saying, you know, we're not on his radar. He doesn't pay attention to us. We're not getting the promotion. So again, you build the relationship with the Beatles and the Merseybeat groups on his personal friendship, his personal relationship with these people.
Yeah.
But you can't be like that with everybody. And whilst he has some good people around him, he has, you know, good PA, he's got Alistair Taylor is there, Peter Brown is there, Jeffrey Ellis is there, these executives. He also runs interference. You know, he wants to be in control. He wants to be in control of the day-to-day stuff, but he doesn't have time. And then sometimes he's not interested. Plus, you know, he's off in Spain looking at bullfighters, or he's, you know.
Well, but that is, yeah, you're right. There's a very specific pattern you see with Brian where he's either dealing with something in minute detail with very specific instructions and control. And invariably that tends to be very much more so for a Beatles-related product. He's got a good relationship with George Martin, so there's a conduit there for them to communicate the music that's being done in Abbey Road on behalf of the band. So this pattern is, you know, Brian's either very, very, very in control or involved, or it has to be a certain way, or else he's not involved at all. And in that not involved realm, he is seemingly very poor at delegating or organizing or saying, well, look, recognizing if I'm not giving this amount of control or specificity to this job, those people can do it. There's a bit of a wilderness around the edges of the NEMS empire.
There is. And I mean, there are constant stories of him telling people, go off and do something, but then barreling in, coming in at the last minute and saying, that's not the way you should have done this. Or, you know, you will not fly to America tomorrow with Robert Stigwood, and then ringing up at midnight to say, why are you not on the plane with Robert Stigwood? You know, so he's will not delegate, will not let people, will not define the areas within people within which people are to exercise their own control. And as you say, either he's completely over every detail, and micromanaging, or else he's giving no direction to anybody and then criticizing when things don't go the way he feels he would have set something up. So it's not the way to run a small business, and it's not the way to run a business with 80 people and five offices. Who needs five different offices in London?
Well,
in different locations, you know.
Well, but they were all on Zoom, weren't they? Who knows?
Yeah, probably.
But he in terms of the Beatles' existence, he had been very much involved in touring, presentation, releases. Yeah. Post Candlestick Park, that changes. There's no Christmas Beatles single or album on the horizon, on the immediate horizon. There's no touring on the immediate horizon. And there's a couple of very telling incidents that are kind of happening that kind of give you an idea of the insight into what Brian is being like at this time. So, like, one of the basic relationships should have been with the Beatles book, which is the monthly Beatles magazine that hopefully everyone listening here all knows, the little colourful banner, the pocket official Beatles magazine that is very much at this time selling many copies and is still a driver for Beatle information, Beatle knowledge. But it's not something that's under the control of Brian.
No. No, it sort of is run alongside separately, but from NEMS and the Beatles, but it has this very close relationship. And as you say, it is the sort of official organ of communication to the fans. And in addition to the stopping touring, one of the things that happens in 66 is, you know, they're not doing television as much. They're kind of not doing those slightly cheesy photo shoots. Above all else, the Beatles book is a photo magazine. So there's just lots and lots and lots of photographs. And they really scaled back doing photo shoots. And of course, the Beatles are changing their look. So their hair is changing and they're growing moustaches.
The old John Mulaney bit, one day they didn't have moustaches. And then the next day they all had moustaches.
So because they don't have up-to-date photographs, and this is just fantastic, Sean O'Mahony, mentioned in Get Back and Dig It, I think, also known as Johnny Dean for the purposes of the We should have names like that. We should adopt
as the editor of the he'd do the editor's page every month in the Beatles
book. As Johnny Dean. But they don't have up to date photographs. So fantastically, he gets his artists to draw mustaches on old photographs of the Beatles to demonstrate their new look. I'm going to have to go and see if I can find some. If we can find some of those photographs, those would be good. So anyway, the good news is this prompts a major showdown with Brian, who comes along with his lawyers.
Excellent.
Never have too many lawyers. And he's basically threatening to close down the magazine and saying, I'll see you in court and I'll shut you down. And these photographs are not true representations. They're not true to the image of the... Of the boys. And Omani said, fine, you want me to tell the public the truth about the boys, and then proceeds to list a whole range of less than
savory stories
about the Beatles to which he is a party, saying, well, I'll print this and I'll print that. And Epstein suddenly realizes, you know, he doesn't have the upper hand here at all, and is forced to back down. And the lawyers, for an appropriate fee, come up with a compromise whereby there's some editorial changes in return for delivery of photographs with real mustaches. But I think there is suddenly a realization here on Brian's part that he does not necessarily hold all the cards in dealings with what is actually should be a very Beatle-friendly, cooperative magazine. And he, instead of going and just having a chat with Sean O'Mahony, he comes in lawyered up, which is, you know, as I say, that's usually a good thing. But, you know, a quiet... cup of tea or a sweet sherry and a chat would probably have ironed the whole thing out without the need for that.
But there's some other kind of instrumentally off things that he's doing. You know, there's you know, they've played their second show at Shea Stadium, and you know, there are examples of Brian making deals that on one side you can kind of forgive him because he's making deals where deals haven't been made before, but he's also doesn't realize perhaps, you know, you're representing the Beatles. You hold all the cards. You can make big demands. He's not really doing that.
No, in some ways, some instances, he's a good negotiator. You know, in some ways, he's just a bit of a pushover. And he unless he's sort of in the mood for conflict, he seems to shy away from conflict sometimes. And as you say, he doesn't seem to realize the bargaining strength of his own position. So, you know, the Beatles make a tidy sum from Shea Stadium. They had grossed $282,000, of which they get $183,000. So that's very nice. But Brian has done a deal with Sid Bernstein to underwrite the ticket sales. And the ticket sales are down. And shortly after they get back from the American tour, Sid Bernstein sends Brian a bill for $800. So
not a huge amount, but even still.
Yeah, but it's just the very fact that NAMs end up having to pay the promoter $800 off the back of a $282,000 show.
And another thing that he's involved in the end of 66 that he's been involved in for a while is the Savile Theatre.
Yes, yes.
And that's something that will loom large in the legend of 67.
It really does. The Savile Theatre becomes a kind of you know, iconic venue for rock concerts. You know, everybody plays there. Chuck Berry, Jimi Hendrix, Procol Harum play there the night that Wider Shade of Pale gets the number one, having been the Paramounts. You know, they just but so yeah. He and again this the idea that he would want to own or lease or run or manage a theatre very much goes back to those days in RADA, I think, where he's...
Well, it's that impresario bug that he has.
It's that, he's the famous impresario, as Paul would take it away.
Yes. But it's something... The Savile Theatre should have been something that could have been nothing but successful. There was successes in Brian leasing and taking over the Savile Theatre. You could even think that the labelling of events as the Beatles Present could have gotten people in the door if he'd wanted to do something like that. But it's he sinks money into these pet projects without really much thought. So if you're a Beatle fan and you think of the Savile Theatre, you're thinking, oh yeah, that's when Jimi Hendrix played there in 67 and it was all cool and groovy. What you didn't realise is that he is sinking huge sums of money into niche, bespoke plays that he wants to see.
Yes, so the building itself needs a lot of work. So there's money going into that. And then he puts on a huge range of plays. So you've got the Solid Gold Cadillac with Sid James and Margaret Rutherford. You know, you'd pay good money to see that. That would be good. But he also micromanages everything. So you know, whether it's the new seats or the layout or the directing of the plays, or he is there and he's interfering and he's clashing with everybody, he's having rows with everybody. He just cannot delegate.
Yeah. And I have to admit, it was only in the run-up to recording this that I realised that when I lived in London, I walked past the Savile Theatre many, many times.
And what is it now, Jason?
It is now an Odeon. It's on Shaftesbury Avenue in London. It's now a four-screen Odeon with a very distinctive brick facade and arch. And it's just right behind or up the road from the FOP, if anyone knows the FOP, on Shaftesbury Avenue. And when I was like, oh, that's the Savile Theatre. So the main outline of the building is still there, but it's a four-screen cinema. It stopped being it was sold in 1969. Yeah, he's doing all of these things on a lease. He's not even owning the theatre.
He could at least have had a property investment. But he it's also in just up the literally a few hundred yards up the street is where the NEM's offices were.
Yeah.
And if you go up there, there's a restaurant whose name escapes me that they have a big picture in the window of saying, you know, the Beatles once ate here, and you can kind of go in and there's photographs of where they held her. So he was kind of in that geographical area. But just to Hendrix play there. Chuck Berry. I think Chuck Berry played there today. I was the day that we were recording this, I think it was the anniversary of the Chuck Berry concert there when there was a riot. The Rolling Stones played there in December 1969. So this is kind of at the absolute peak of the Stones, you know, where they're playing Madison Square Gardens and they're playing there. December 67, Yoko performed her The Fog Machine, Music of the Mind, which included a projection of the film Bottoms in the men's toilets. So Fairport Convention, the Incredible String Band, the Bee Gees, the Beatles made Hello Goodbye there. And of course, perhaps best of all, The Move played there.
The Move. Was that one of their riotous gigs? I can't remember, where they smashed televisions and cars. I think that was up at the Roundhouse, actually.
We now have 2 hours on the move from our move correspondent.
My move notes here. When people talk about Brian's business dealings, there is the Seal Tab debacle that often gets mentioned. So we probably should mention Seal Tab.
I'm glad you've said Seal Tab, because for years and years and years I used to read that as Seal Tab Seal Tab is clearly Seal Tab. No, I think Seal Tab is absolutely right. It's just I remember I'm going completely off on a tangent here. There was an album by Carlos Santana and John McLaughlin that I used to refer to as Onanes. Until somebody pointed out to me that it's actually Oneness is the...
Well, I'm probably pronouncing it wrong because it's Beatles backwards. So it's probably
that's what I was going for. But I think Seal Tab, for the sake of my sanity, I think Seal Tab is how we go with it.
What is it?
Seal Tab. Yeah, Seal Tab is... basically, it goes back to sort of 63, 64, when as soon as the Beatles started to become huge, immediately Brian is besieged by people saying, can I put Ringo's face on a tea towel, or can I have a John Lennon toothbrush, or a Paul McCartney toilet roll holder, or a George Harrison lavatory brush? Everything. People just wanted to brand everything. And initially, Brian dealt with these himself, obviously, but eventually it became too much, and he really needed someone to run interference, deal with all of those things, and the best thing to do was to set up some kind of third-party licensee who could deal with this. So he turned to a friend of his, David Jacobs, who is described here as the then leading show business lawyer in Britain, representing Laurence Olivier, Judy Garland, Zsa Zsa Gabor, and Brian Epstein. And he'd been involved in the Profumo case. So he's kind of very high profile.
Yes,
like
and
myself.
He's not the David Jacobs British. He's not the British broadcaster David Jacobs. This is a different...
David Jacobs of Jukebox Jury. No, completely different.
This is a different David Jacobs altogether.
Different David. Different.
So he is sent off as kind of the, as you say, to run interference and to be the go-between man to decide what needs to be done for Seal Tab. And he makes a brilliant deal, right?
He makes a brilliant deal. And as anybody would, you would think, well, who do I know on the fantastic showbiz circuit party scene that might be interested in doing this? And he literally just gets some guy that he knows, that he's friendly with, from this, I suspect, slightly unsavory party scene. Am I allowed to say that?
I don't know. I don't know what you mean.
We wait to hear from somebody's somebody's lawyers. But he gets in. He basically gets in touch with this guy called Nicky Byrne, and said, you know, would you be interested in doing this? Now, Brian Epstein has given him, David Jacobs, complete authority to go off and sort this out. And of course, you know, they say, but Brian didn't know much about merchandising. David Jacobs doesn't know much about merchandising. Anyway, he speaks to Nicky Byrne, who isn't initially particularly keen, but he's got a contract. He comes back to Jacobs' office on the 4th of December, 1963, leaving blank the various percentages, the kind of split between what he will take, what NEMS will take. Jacob says, well, what do you think? And Byrne said, oh, just put in 10%. And Byrne says he expected Epstein to come back and do a bit of negotiation. This typical percentage might have been 75 or 80% for NEMS at this stage, because Byrne is just going to be the broker.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's NEMS that holds the image rights effectively. But Jacobs just fills the contract in, takes it to Epstein. Epstein initials it, and there you go. Jacobs' advice being 10% is better than nothing.
It's a huge loss of money, to put it mildly.
It is. In my defense, for the negligence of the lawyer, he's not wrong. 10% is better than nothing.
Yeah, but 10% when they possibly could have been looking for a standard rate of about 80%, that's handing over a significant chunk of cash to the people in between. And that also means a significant chunk of cash for more lawyers.
For more lawyers. So again, it's a kind of win-win situation. But I think essentially when we're talking about these big, big numbers across everything the Beatles are doing in terms of record sales and ticket sales and all the rest of it, but they're getting small percentages of royalties on the records. They're getting, you know, we've seen they ended up having to pay $800 to the promoter for Shea Stadium. Seal Tab licensed 150 different items almost immediately. Dolls, scarves, mugs, bathwater, wigs, t-shirts, bubblegum, licorice, empty cans of Beetle breath.
That's very. There's people on TikTok doing that these days.
It is. I was going to say, yeah. And presumably, like, here's some of Ringo's old bathwater. I mean, anyway. So, to give you an example of how this works, Nicky Byrne's company, Seal Tab, charges 10% commission to the merchandisers to get the license. So, for every $100, he gets $10. And then out of that $10, he gives 10% to Brian Epstein, which is $1.
Jeez.
So, capitalism, capitalism.
Well, a certain Mr. P. McCartney, when asked in later years what he thought, said, we got screwed for millions.
It's not about the money.
The Beatles it's may not.
It's about the bathwater.
Did the Beatles know at the time? Maybe not. They didn't, really.
This is a question, because what happens is, Brian realizes pretty quickly you know, Byrne turns up and gives him a check for you know, I think it was £9,000 or something. And he said, okay, out of this, how much have you to get? And he goes, no, that's your share. That's you. That is your 10%. And Brian suddenly realizes this is a disaster, that this has gone completely wrong. Ultimately, it ends up he is able to renegotiate a more favorable commission.
Yeah.
The following year, by August, he's getting 49% by August 1964. But by this point, he's become embroiled in court proceedings.
Yeah.
This is really the disaster. You know, we have the initial disaster of signing the contract, but then the way in which it's handled. So he then sues Sealtab in New York, alleging, you know, improper accounting. This is in December 1964. There's a counterclaim saying that Nehms and Epstein were surreptitiously issuing licenses to other people. There's a whole kind of standoff. Brian tells his own employees, just deal directly with the bathwater salesman. Don't go to Nicky Byrne. So he then gets a counterclaim for $5 million in damages. The whole thing escalates. He refuses in 1965. Brian refuses to fly to America and give a deposition, you know, to sit down for a sworn statement. He says he's not going to do it. Although he admits that he's probably not qualified to answer the questions that are going to, which is a startling omission given that, you know, he's head of the whole thing. Anyway, because of all of this, and because by sort of 66, the touring is becoming more problematic, you've got the Bigger Than Jesus, people like Woolworths, JCPenney's, other companies refuse to finalize any merchandising agreements, and they cancel orders worth, wait for it, $78 million.
Ooh.
So the estimate is that they lost the court case, the contract, all of that, lost Nehms and the Beatles approximately $100 million.
Oof.
So the Beatles, the merchandisers back off the touring, but for various reasons, but also because you don't know, they don't know who they're dealing with.
Yeah.
By the time all of this sort of works its way through the courts, and I should say Sealtab all fall out amongst themselves as well. There's sort of lots of other subsidiary lawsuits going on internally. But by the time this is all over and settled, the Beatles have stopped touring. The merchandising mania has faded. It's now Herman's Hermits and the Monkees. And and all of those people are learning from the mistakes that Brian went. And Alistair Taylor has a quote, and he said, we did our best. Some people have said it wasn't good enough. That's easy to say with 2020 hindsight. But remember, there were no rules. We were making it up as we went along. But my favorite quote is from Tony Bramwell. Mm. And he said, Brian Epstein floundered all the way to the top. And I think that's harsh, but I think there's maybe an element of truth. And did the Beatles know or did they not know? You'd think this would get a lot of publicity, this kind of litigation. But were the Beatles really paying much attention to that? Brian, certainly his contract was coming to an end. His management contract, the recording contract, was up for renegotiation as well. And there's a suggestion that this is really the thing that was most preying on Brian's mind. If the Beatles find out that I've lost them $100 million, they're not going to be best pleased, and they might not stick with me, and I might lose the Beatles. And that seems to be uppermost in his mind, that of all of the things that are going on and all of the stresses that he is under at this point, this is the biggest thing. And it makes sense that the Beatles would not have known the detail of this. They might know, you know, they were surrounded by lawyers and surrounded by lawsuits. This is just maybe another lawsuit, and they maybe didn't realize the full extent of it.
So when we look at this snapshot at the end of 66, there's a lot going on, but also Brian's position. He's worried about what his role is as somebody who organizes concerts and organizes recordings if they're not happening. But on paper, he should also be worried because the Beatles, their contract with EMI is up, their contract with him is up.
Yeah.
And that just adds to the whole levels of unknown in somebody who perhaps isn't the most secure person day to day anyway.
I think this is exactly it. You know, so as we reach the end of 66, he's got all of these pressures. His personal relationship with the Beatles still seems to be good, although as you said early on, they're all going off in their own things. They're starting to sort of broaden. You know, Lennon's doing film, but George is in India, Paul is wearing disguises. Mm-hmm. It's all of this is coming to bear, and the pressures are building in his personal life, in his business life.
So where can it go next? I guess we'll have to find out in part two of Brian Epstein's last year. We're available in all the usual places, on Twitter at BeatlesPod, the Nothing's Real Facebook group, the website www.nothingisrealpod.com, which is a gateway to all our other stuff, our past episodes, discussions, playlists, YouTube, and all the rest. And we're always happy to people to get in touch and to get involved. But for now, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.